Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again today, our special guest is Robert England. Robert is a journalist and author who has written extensively on mortgage finance, banking, retirement policy, and the financial and economic impact of aging population. His most current work is Black Box Casino, How Wall Street Risky Shadow Banking Crashed Global Finance. His previous works include Aging China, The Demographic Challenge to China's Economic Prospects. Robert is a senior writer for Mortgage Banker magazine. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Used to be that we, in our mind, we think, okay, we go to the bank, get a loan, we make a payment to them until we pay it off, and they hold the loan the whole time. That was called a portfolio loan. And then when all this came down, and I think, honestly, it wasn't until 2007 and maybe even late in 2007 that I even heard the term mortgage-backed security and CDO. And I know you're much more familiar with the industry. Was that really commonly understood by even people that were in the loan business, understood the path that the paper took and how it was disseminated?
Well, I think the people involved with mortgage originations understood it, but maybe not so much other people involved in the housing sector, that the loans were being put into portfolios and securities were being issued against that loan portfolio so that investors were the ultimate funders of the mortgage loans and not banks.
Okay, now, were they the secondary funder or were they the original funder?
Well, the money was funded temporarily by the mortgage originator.
Okay, that's why I was wondering if the mortgage originator really didn't completely understand the process by which he got his money back or his credit line cleaned off.
Well, all they did, the mortgage originator would obtain a warehouse line of credit from a bank if they were actual mortgage banker as opposed to a broker.
Right.
If they weren't involved, a correspondent lender, and they... They would have money just to the point that the loan closed, and then the loan was sold to an investor. And there, for the mortgage originator, the investor was either Fannie or Freddie or a bank that was acquiring the loan. And they did not really know what happened to the loan after that.
Right. They didn't have to know that. They just knew that they were creating loans, and the demand for them kept increasing, even though maybe the quality was decreasing.
Yes. Against all logic.
Now, out of the mortgage-backed security world came this product called a CDO. So can you explain what that is?
Well, the CDO is a collateralized debt obligation, and this type of instrument began to be used as early as the 1980s, and it was to take existing corporate debt and roll that into a pool of loans and issue securities against that pool of corporate bonds, and that idea, you know, was used, I would say, it never became a huge amount of business, and it was tried later for bonds from developing nations and other kinds of debt instruments. And in the early the market would rise and fall, and it would, you know, sort of vanish away, and someone was always trying to come up with another way to use a CDO, which is just another form of securitization. And in the 1999, I think it was Prudential, came up with the idea of having a CDO that put together mortgage-backed securities into a pool and issued securities against those securities. So you were securitizing securities.
And the concept of a tranche, I thought that actually that was pretty brilliant. You know, if it was done correctly, it seems like that would be a very good vehicle.
Well, in the private label mortgage-backed securities world, you know, they all had tranches even before the CDO, and every deal had as much of the deal as possible would be set up as AAA rated, and that would be a tranche. These were credit rating tranches, and I think about 94% of most MBS deals backed, you know, we're backed, we're AAA rated.
By who, by the way?
Hmm?
By who?
By the credit rating agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch.
Were they paid fees to you know, buy the Wall Street firms for that?
They were, and they also were rated the CDOs, and this huge volume of both mortgage, private label mortgage-backed securities and CDOs did not really take off until after 1999, and there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision came up with the concept of having the idea of risk-weighted capital standards apply to these kinds of instruments, financial instruments, and to give the credit rating agencies the job of determining their credit rating and thus determining the amount of capital banks would hold against those tranches of the deals. And what the Basel Committee is really representing the central banks of the world.
Right.
So then the central bankers never really thought this through, and they were actually creating a monster here because by giving this role to the credit rating agencies, they had made a big mistake. And ironically, considering what happened, when the idea was first proposed, Moody's Investor Service wrote a letter in response to the proposal and suggested that it not be done, that it would corrupt the credit rating standard and that it created moral hazard. And yet the Basel Committee ignored that, and the various countries adopted these standards, including the United States in 2001, that gave the credit rating agencies that role.
And the same year, there's a Graham-Leach-Bliley Act that also did away with the last of the Glass-Steagall Act and barred the SEC from regulating the investment banking holding companies.
Yes, it did. It left the investment banking companies, which were already, of course, independent, thanks to Glass-Steagall, did not have a prudential regulatory regime. I guess the Graham-Leach-Bliley sort of cast that in stone. There was a battle subsequently with the Europeans over this,
mm-hmm.
and Congress first passed a law allowing a voluntary regulatory regime to be established for the bank holding companies or the investment banking firms, and then under William Donaldson, the SEC chairman, one was implemented. What they did was adopt wholesale the Basel standard regime that was put together for banks. And, of course, all of this banking regulation is based on the idea that banks have deposits and taxpayers are exposed to deposits and banks hold assets for a long time, and that we're protecting the taxpayers from losses. But investment banks don't hold deposits. Investment banks are involved with FDIC. Investment banks, by the nature of their business, should not be holding assets for a very long time. They should create markets. They were, as many in the business once said, they were in the moving business, moving assets, and not a moving and storage business. But by adopting this regulatory regime in 2004, voluntarily of the United States gave the bank holding companies of investment banks the incentive to hold, buy and hold assets.
And the use of tremendous leverage, again, especially mortgage-backed securities.
Raise their high leverage because risk-weighted capital standards is supposed to discourage banks from taking on assets with high risk. But what they really did was create incentives for banks to take on assets with low capital ratings, which may or may not be risky. And so the investment banking firms did the same thing the banks were doing, loading up on these assets.
Where did the money come from to actually fund things like CDOs?
Well, the money comes from investors. And the
and it had to be rated AAA to attract a lot of money, correct?
Yes. Well, there were two things were going on in the early days of the CDO. There were two groups. There were institutional investors who invested in the CDOs that contained mortgage-backed securities or even subprime. And banks were also creating CDOs to get the lower-rated tranches of mortgage-backed securities off their books by turning, and all the capital was involved, that they couldn't sell them, and they were trying to get rid of them. And so they would put them into CDOs, and they would become AAA-rated. Now, the institutional investors had lost interest in the lower-rated tranches of the private label mortgage-backed securities, the prime particularly, around 2003, and so the CDO was a way to recycle those assets that institutional investors wouldn't buy by turning them into AAAs. It was kind of alchemy.
Yeah, you took the worst over here, and magically they transformed into the new pile of the best.
And by making it very opaque, some investors could be enticed into investing in it who didn't understand it. And so these were actually black boxes.
And they were, at the last few years, those were mostly foreign investors?
Yes. After 2003, as I was saying, the U.S. investors, based institutional investors, were not buying this. And the investors who were willing to buy it had incentive to buy dollar assets and were looking for bond assets. They had trade surpluses, or they had recycled petrodollars. They had lots of dollar-denominated funds, you know, money that they had huge piles of dollars, as it were, and they needed to invest them in dollar assets in order to avoid currency risk. And so the Asian and European banks and other institutional investors were buying these CDOs without much regard for what was in it, and you couldn't really know what was in it. And they didn't quite get the level of risk that was there because they were rated AAA.
Correct. The credit default swap, what role did that play in this world of CDOs?
Well, the credit default swap is a form of insurance in which one side sells credit protection against the bonds or mortgage-backed securities, in this case, that the payments would be made, and the other side buys the insurance. And the availability of credit default swaps made it possible to create synthetic CDOs on a massive scale beginning around 2005. They had existed before, and people were buying credit default swaps to protect their risks for owning certain tranches of the mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
And then they applied that concept to the CDO. But the synthetic CDO was created entirely with credit default swaps. The actual assets were a pool of credit default swaps. And the entity issuing the synthetic CDO was insuring their performance. And they would turn around in turn and try to get insurance that would cover their losses if they couldn't, if the bonds failed or the notes failed. And the provider of that was AIG's Financial Products Division, which sold all that protection for many years.
Now, interestingly, there were other companies that did it as well, but not nearly the size. Is that correct?
That's right. The monoline bond insurance companies that were state-owned companies regulated by state regulators got involved, and to their own detriment.
Right, and when they went out of business, whoever was supposed to get in the insurance coverage just lost.
Yeah, what happened, of course, is the issuers like Merrill Lynch and Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and whoever were issuing, were putting together these synthetic CDOs, and they were backing, they were providing the insurance, and they in turn often could not buy it. Now, Goldman Sachs was able to get it. But Merrill Lynch and Citigroup increasingly did not, weren't able to buy the protection and just continued to put together synthetic CDOs without it.
So they were the designated bag holder at that point?
They ended up owning all of these, what they're called super senior tranches, which is the part of the deal that is made up of the credit default swaps. And so Citigroup tried to hide these assets off its balance sheet and in trading accounts on its balance sheet. When the investment banking regulation was adopted, I referred to for the bank holding companies, the Wall Street firms got a provision in there that allowed them to mark to model anything held in, in their trading accounts on their books, and Citigroup did that as well as many others, if you know it hadn't traded recently. And but Citigroup was also putting these assets into structured investment vehicles, or SIVs, which are more black boxes, off its balance sheet, and those were funded, by the way, with asset-backed commercial paper, which was backed in some cases by subprime mortgages. So the Citigroup had over $50 billion worth of toxic assets at the time of the crisis, and they were telling the public they had practically no subprime exposure.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that usually the person holding the credit default swap had the other side of the transaction, but that wasn't even necessary to get a credit default swap. Is that correct?
No. The issuer, because the issuer, someone was buying protection and someone selling, and the, say, Merrill Lynch is putting together a deal, and they were holding their side of the, they were providing credit protection to the other party that was in the deal.
Right. But if someone like Kyle Bass comes in and says, he can buy, couldn't he invest in a credit default swap and not have the other side?
Yeah, you can. You only take one side. You take the protection side.
Right.
The buyers are doing that. And so you can also, bet against some of the various parts of the deal, which is what the hedge funds did. But they were buying, you know, the smart people were buying the protection, and the, shall I say, the less smart people.
But and they were, and they considered themselves smart people too, right?
They did, of course. But because of these CDOs were such black boxes, and the general public didn't realize how many bad loans there were out there, including investors, they assumed, you know, that the deals would function, that the people would pay their mortgages. They did not see the dangers. But the hedge funds, lots of hedge funds did see the dangers, and they began to sponsor CDOs in order to create tranches they could bet against.
Yes. So they were selling a product they knew was going to fail, and then they bet against its failure.
Well, that's what was alleged with Goldman Sachs in the deal that got so much attention in Congress, the Abacus deal.
Yes.
But what the hedge funds did was slightly different, and it's not clear to the extent to which the investment banking firms knew about this or whether the people at the top knew about it. Maybe the people putting together the deals knew. But hedge funds would sponsor CDOs, say at Merrill Lynch, and they would buy the equity tranche, and then the banks would have to sell the AAA and the triple Bs and so on to someone else, and the there were CDO managers, and the hedge funds were not supposed to influence the choice of assets that went into the CDO. That was how investors were assured that this was done with integrity. But certain hedge funds, you know, appear to influence, it isn't always entirely provable because it was done in ways that are difficult to trace, the selection of the assets in the CDOs. And this happened very often with certain hedge funds like Magnetar, based in Chicago, and the deals in which they sponsored the CDOs, $50 billion worth of CDOs, they all failed spectacularly. And the CDO managers, you know, picked the worst assets out there. Now, the question is, did Merrill Lynch, in this case, know what was going on? And if they may have. We don't know. These things are all undergoing litigation. But logically, you would think that they had to know something. The people at the top are the ones who probably fully understand what was going on.
Which is interesting. That seems to happen to where they probably may not even understand completely the concepts that are emerging constantly, the new toy that these guys are implementing and selling.
Well, you wonder about someone like Stanley O'Neill, who was supercharging at Merrill Lynch and Chuck Prince at Citigroup, who were supercharging the CDO business at the worst possible moment because they decided it was very lucrative. Were they really that foolish and unaware? And it's hard to know.
Naked short selling, and I'm going to just I want to talk a little bit about Bear Stearns because in the book it talks about there was one trader that actually earned more doing one trade than Bear Stearns was sold for. And did he use a naked short to do that?
Yes. Naked short selling was pretty much made impossible to do with the uptick rule. I mean, you could still do naked short selling, but it was difficult to execute.
And an uptick means the stock has to move up.
It has to rise, yes, and then before it goes back down.
See, I wouldn't have known that unless you told me. That was good.
The naked short selling is selling shares of stocks that you don't own or borrow, and it's illegal, and it's done to manipulate markets to achieve outcomes that the manipulator, of course, is desiring to do. And in March of 2008, someone placed a $1.7 million naked short sale. Actually, they bought an option that for $1.7 million. It wouldn't pay off unless the share price of Bear Stearns collapsed within, like, 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately after this happened, rumors were circulated throughout the industry that Bear Stearns did not have enough cash, was low on cash, even though it had $18 billion in cash. And brokerage firms started pulling their money out of Bear Stearns. And within days, they only had $2 billion in cash, and they were on the verge of collapse. And over that Bear Stearns weekend in March 2008, the sale of Bear Stearns was negotiated by Hank Paulson and the Fed, and, as many of us recall. And in the initial deal, it was only $2 a share. The person who made the $1.7 million bet made $270 million off that bet. And the company, I think, was sold for $236 million, which was worth less than the value of the corporate headquarters of Bear Stearns.
That's amazing. We only have a couple minutes left. I'm going to read a quote, and then I want to connect that to a dot that's probably coming down the pike. Bear Stearns was vulnerable to runs because, like most Wall Street, it had been funding its operation from short-term secured and unsecured cash. When these short-term arrangements did not roll over, new arrangements could not be secured. Cash was drained out of the firm. We now have sovereign debt. And in a book, Boomerang, Kyle Bass is at it once again, and he has done his job of doing credit default swaps on Greece, let's say, paying $1.10 for $1 million coverage, or I'm sorry, $1,100 for $1 million coverage. How many times over, I don't know. Do you see that this same setup that really damaged the world's economic, done in mortgage, do you see that round two might be sovereign?
Yes, indeed. In fact, and it derives from that same problem with giving assets too low a risk weighting. And in Europe, of course, sovereigns require zero capital.
Right.
And originally that was supposed to apply to AAAs and AAs, but in effect it still applies to lower rated tranches. And, you know, you could own a lot of these assets and fund them through overnight lending, and of course banks are funding a lot of things through overnight lending anyhow, and confidence in the system could vanish and people would want their cash back, or what they actually did was a haircut for the overnight lending. They would then demand more and more assets,
right,
until it was effectively the price of the asset was declining, but it was being affected by cash being drained out of the system.
Robert, yeah. We're out of time. I've really enjoyed this. We'll have to do this again. Robert England, author of Black Box Casino.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.